you laughed at me for taking mending, but yeah. Now I have one intact body.
I saw you laugh when I said that that was a component of a spell, but I mean, you need it if you're going to do anything less than true res, right?
I mean, or you can, you know, take expertise in weaver's tools, right?
Sure. Live from the Mundangerous Lazarus Pit in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 271 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're discussing the forbidden dark art of necromancy. But first, the party puts a thumb in an eye in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, it's her business, her rules, when Ash shows up in the Character Creation Forge.
Thank God for those Overwatch voice lines, or else I would have nothing to introduce Overwatch Tober characters.
I have no idea what we're talking about, but I'm going to go with it. Is this Pokeballs? Is that what's happening?
Something like that. All right, Ishan, where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
So the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And in southern Carnath, on the edge of the Mornland, the party is chasing a killer. A massive undead creature formed of the cast-offs of corpses emerges from the pool of goo. Its huge dead eye is supported by bony tentacles, and it lashes out at the party, who are now mostly in the form of great beasts. But then, the creature reveals one new ability, a Bodax Death Gaze.
So it stares and hits Warden and Switch full on, knocking Warden out of his animal form and sending Switch to the floor unconscious. Another Stitch zombie crawls out of the bubbling pool and howls over her body, but cannot drain her of blood thanks to her new periaptive wound closure, something we rightfully equipped on the oft-dying paladin.
Turns out there's an extra ability that wasn't listed on the box. We didn't know that, but hey.
Right.
Very convenient. But then the large undead teleports, as we've seen these Stitch zombies do before, and it creates balls of painful darkness where it was and where it appears. Fortunately, though, you have a druid.
Yeah, who is conveniently not currently a bear. And so Warden dispels them, filling the room with the light of day, casting daylight. Both creatures recoil from the light, but the eye creature consumes the other and then attacks with renewed vigor.
So nearing the end of their resources, constantly pummeled by this flurry of bony tentacles and unsure how to kill this thing that should already be dead, Bramble is searching desperately for something effective to do.
And big Bramble vibes.
I don't know. I can't hypnotize it. What do I do? Which is usually totally the most effective course, typically.
So the rest of the group is yelling at him to try healing this thing, channel some positive energy into this undead abomination. And when he does that, it fills its bloated form with this positive light, and then it explodes into a burst of light and ash.
And finally, all is quiet, and the party once again retreats to a corner of this room to patch up their wounds. Then, taking a look at the map that the now-dead acolyte drew for them, they decide to search the remainder of the facility to find everything else that might be lurking here. In the Gray House, they find some twig blights and quickly burn those to death, and they discover a novitiate's pack in the barracks. Inside, they find a bag of holding, finally, a pair of dark goggles, and a spell shard inscribed with a cantrip called Exsanguinate.
Then in Pol's chambers, they find the rest of her notes. The author is a person of refined tastes and dark humor who enjoys pondering the oddness of her situation, trapped in a child's body, occasionally subject to the needs and whims of her new form. Giggling is an odd sensation, and she misses Riedra, fine wine, and fencing. And then wonders where Elaine, Gersey, and the others might be now.
Yeah, so she's like, hey, I'm 9 years old and I'm tiny, which means it takes a quarter of a bottle of wine to get me drunk now.
Right. And also, I get really tired going up the stairs and I have to take a nap in the afternoon. I'm real cranky.
Everything's so tall. Well, how do these halflings live like this?
I hate eating vegetables.
Wait, I'm in charge. I don't have to eat vegetables.
Right.
Of course, also, those names, Elaine, Gersi, and the others, indicate that there are probably other mind seeds out there. So, now in the meantime, Pol has been working on reversing the power of the Mark of Healing, creating halfling acolytes with the power to injure instead of to heal using their dragon mark power. And Exsanguinate is a reversed version of a secret Durasco cantrip that is typically used to move vital fluids into a body quickly for transfusions or things like that, or to rebalance humors. She also muses that the undead creatures that she's been able to make in the sarcophagi, oddly, can be killed by the very water that gave them life in the first place, water from the Mornland.
Then Lenore finds a secret compartment by Pol's desk that has no latch and no amount of force will open it. But remembering the embossed inscription on the journal she found, she repeats the phrase aloud. On the Psyche, no scars remain. A little cubby pops open, and inside is a stone whistle with the Riadrin name Nightcaller carved into it, as well as a fine dark rapier with a black scabbard wrapped in sheer gray silk.
And we'll find out what happens next. Next week.
So this week, we are talking about necromancy.
You said forbidden art, but I mean, is it though?
Well, I think that depends on your setting, doesn't it?
You just kill the people who are upset about it and then raise them as an army of undead minions.
And then who can say no?
Right? All right, so what is necromancy? What are we actually going to be talking about this episode?
So in the real world, right, in Earth, in our world, necromancy is the magic of communicating with the dead, right? These are seances. This is your Ouija board. This is your various little rituals and grimoires and all sorts of things in order to somehow contact the spirits of those who've left. Not that that's real, but, you know, that's what it comes to mean or represent. In D&D terms, most communication with spirits is actually divination. So necromancy includes some communication with the dead, right? Speak with dead. But it also includes raising the dead either back to life or as undead abominations, or channeling negative energy to create disease and other harmful effects.
So good stuff, bad stuff. I think you'll see, like, historically, specifically in D&D, but, you know, in a lot of fantasy settings, you look at the, if you separate the mechanics from the lore, you'll have, you know, abilities or spells or whatever that are sort of like deemed like good or bad, but then that doesn't necessarily line up with whether or not they have the necromancy descriptor or they belong in that school or whatever. So there's been a lot of confusion and conflict among gamers about like what exactly necromancy means.
Yeah, necromancy is the only school that gets like tagged with just evil, right?
Right.
like everyone is like, okay, so sure, like nobody says divination is inherently good, but maybe divination is slightly more like, you know, godfully, clerically aligned. But necromancy, it's just like, oh, if you necromancer, you're evil. Even though right. We still want clerics to do our raised dead for us.
I made a puppet out of a corpse, and that makes me a horrible person who's definitely going to Hades. But Fireball, they killed all those peasants. That's fine.
Right. I like how, like, animate dead and create undead. Basically, like, spoil the whole batch. Though then again, it does have spells like blight and harm. And, like, it's not necessarily the most positive, but not more harmful than Fireball.
There are some games where, like, cure wounds is necromancy.
Right.
All right. So how do you use it in a game?
So there's the mechanics of it, right? So in 5e, most of necromancy spells are going to be instantaneous. They're usually brief transfers of negative energy, often with like longer lasting effects, right? So this is like your revivify, your blight, your contagion, your vampiric touch, harm. You know, they're quick. And then once they're done, like the effect usually sticks around. Like there's not a ton of necromancy spells that are just like, oh, I damage you for necrotic. It's usually I damage you for necrotic and something. Right. Unlike kind of like evocation or things that are just pure damage.
Yes. The lingering evil effects of the negative energy plane.
Right.
You also get pretty powerful spells, but they will usually be rituals or they'll, you know, take a long time to cast, maybe a minute or an hour, which mechanically means that they're not really meant to be used in combat. Things like raise dead, resurrection, true resurrection, or like flavorful things that can really muck up your game, like clone.
And then the other thing about necromancy spells is they're often dependent on specific components that are consumed in the process. You get, you know, your expensive and therefore rare diamonds, silver cages, a mostly intact body, you know, different components that you need to plan for and sort of reflect that necromancy isn't a whimsical thing. It's a thing that you need to be devoted to in order to execute.
I mean, you laughed at me for taking mending, but yeah. Now I have one intact body.
I like it. I saw you laugh when I said that was a component of a spell, but I mean, you need it if you're going to do anything less than true res, right?
I mean, or you can, you know, take expertise in weaver's tools, right?
Sure.
and mechanically, this is the trade-off, right? Like, you have expensive components up front, but you usually end up with some sort of like long-lasting effect. You either have like, you know, an undead servant that follows you around, or you have a companion who is alive and can do stuff and talk.
Right. And, you know, has agency and doesn't send your friend home for the night.
Right.
And then there's the flavor of necromancy, which I think is where a lot of what's interesting about necromancy really comes in. So you have all the trappings first. You've got your, you know, your ritualized casting, your grimoires made from human flesh. You have your different baubles. You have your bones and other macabre remains. Of course, you can use chalk, salts, like any of those types of things to kind of like flavor your ritual as being kind of dark and macabre, right? Because that's what necromancy is. It's the magic of the dead.
It's 90s magic, 90s goth magic.
Sure.
Yeah. Is this the lizard folk episode? Is that what's happening? Flavoring your undead ritual. So you've also got, you know, quick channeling, things like, you know, a grim visage, or, you know, a flash of darkness and shadow, or maybe like in a 40k sense, right? You're a psyker channeling the energy of the warp, and you know that causes hoarfrost to cover like every surface within 100 feet of you, or like people feel chill down in their bones.
Yeah. And then also think about like, what impact does channeling negative energy have on the person doing it, right? Are they in physical pain? Are they in like spiritual pain? Are they feeling their soul like pulled from their body as they channel this negative energy? Do they feel empowered, right? Are they sort of emboldened by like undead infusion of energy, right? Like, they don't feel more human, they just feel more powerful.
Yeah, I'm huffing ghost rock.
Right.
Mad science tastes great.
Exactly. It's the meth of the magical world.
Are they getting like a flashback or a glimpse of the life of the spirit that they're channeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes to like, what is negative energy, mm-hmm. right? Like, what, I mean, positive energy is, so, everyone wants to be like, oh, it's like, it's the energy of good. But like, what is negative? Like, where does negative energy come from? Where does evil energy come from? Like, if it's coming from like harvesting spirits, sort of as they pass through from like, you know, our world to the next, like, then maybe you are kind of like interrupting that natural order, a natural progression, and then that has a cost on you.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to think, like, no matter how you or your party wants to define necromancy, the fun of it in a game often comes from that tension between like, what do the common folk think of it? And then what does the necromancer think of it? And what are other people in the party think of it?
Yeah.
So like, you can totally lean into like this, oh, it's spooky and evil and creepy if you want. You can also play around with it and have fun and be like a Harry Potter or wizard or witch who's like, oh yeah, Eyes of Newt. That's not so weird. Or even like Ghostbusters, like, it isn't the plane of negative energy. It's like, it's just ectoplasm and goo.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always this like this spooky element. Like, at the very least, it's like Halloween, you know? So that there's something to mess around with in the game, rather than just being like a, you know, a science wizard.
Right. So you talked about this. How do common people feel about raising the dead, like, or communing with their spirits, or using energy that is, you know, routed and empowered by death? Are you like a miracle maker? You know, like, are you the necromancer in in The Princess Bride. could you provide a service that no one else can and that makes you like special and valuable? Or are you a dangerous witch who provides a service that no one else can because no one else is so evil that they would consider it?
You see, I got tattoos on my knuckles, so when they bring me back to life, they know why they're doing it. It says, to blave. it can be both of these things, right? Like, you can be a dangerous witch, or like the necromancer can be a dangerous witch, and like the party still needs to approach them, or like the peasant who, you know, desperately wants someone to fall in love with them still makes the arduous journey into the swamp to find the witch because they actually have the power to like bring back a lost love.
Right.
And then think about, what do other magic practitioners feel, right? Like, often necromancy is just one school of magic. It's not the only kind. And these are the people who are basically shunned because, I don't know, maybe you're giving all the rest of us bad names. Fireballs can be used for helpful things. I can boil water for engines.
Right. Like, if the, you know, if the cleric, the druid, and the necromancer are all kind of wrapped into the same bucket of witches, well, that's inconvenient for two of the three.
And perhaps very convenient for the necromancer, who's like, great, I'll blend in.
Right.
I just made a corpse to power the engines. Don't open the hood. No, just step away from the car.
Step away from the Snowpiercer, please. So also, a lot of times you'll have sort of negative stereotypes associated with necromancers as grave robbers, diabolists, or, you know, witches. Question, is that unfair? Right? Like, is that just, you know, backwater mythology taking over? Or is that an earned reputation? Like, is it something that you deserve to be considered? Like, necromancers do that stuff because they have to, because, you know, some pressure is being put on them that prevents them from practicing otherwise.
Yeah, Dr. Frankenstein actually did send Igor to rob graves.
Right.
That's how he made the monster.
Exactly. You know, you can also just always, like, kind of ask the question, like, hey, is Dr. Frankenstein, like, is he playing into type? You know, like, is he the monster here? Or is he one of many Dr. Frankensteins out there who are providing a valuable service, right? Like, whatever that outlook is, like, are you leaning into it or are you fighting against it, right? Is Dr. Frankenstein proving that, hey, like, we can create unlife, and that's a net positive for the world? Right? Like, now we don't need to worry about, say, fighting wars or doing menial labor the way that Carnath has sort of adopted.
Mm-hmm, right? And they're easily controllable with piercing damage and fire.
Exactly. And just this mental command that only I can give, and it'll be fine.
So this is an opportunity to, you know, decide what is the characterization in the game world, and then decide how you're playing into that, either playing it up or opposing it. And then, of course, you're going to want to think about the morality of necromantic acts. Channeling negative energy isn't explicitly evil in current D&D. There are other versions of D&D in the past where certain kinds of necromancy were like explicitly evil because they had a specific tag on it, but that certainly isn't the case for every kind of game.
Yeah, they were straight fall from grace, you know, paladin becomes fighter like kind of spells, right?
Can't believe you tortured them with that spell rather than hacking their limbs off one by one.
Right. But, you know, for your moral compass in your game, you want to ask, like, is it okay to raise the dead, right? Either as, you know, living or undead. And then, you know, what about just disturbing restful spirits, you know, calling spirits back from other realms to, you know, at your command? Is that something that is okay? Is that a valuable service or a cost that like shouldn't exist?
Yeah, this is a nice opportunity. Like, if you're going to make necromancy a part of your game and a part of your story that actually matters, rather than just like, you know, hey, one character's playing a necromancer and like that's how the flavor of their abilities or whatever, you have a chance to really dive into different aspects of your lore. Like, first off, you think about your theology. All of the different religions in your setting have a story about what happens when you die. Where does the soul go? Is there a soul? Like, do you wander somewhere? Do you ascend to the upper planes or whatever? And there's going to be like truth or fiction in there that you can mine. Like if you bring a corpse back, how is it powered? Is it, you know, sucking in energy from the negative plane and somehow that's corrupting the world? And, you know, this is like an environmentalism metaphor. Or like, have you actually like taken an immortal soul and like trapped it inside a corpse and it's just howling in agony for all eternity? You know, these will determine whether or not these are evil acts.
Right. Like, exactly. Like, are they an abomination because of one of those things? Or are they, you know, just another resource that's perhaps a little distasteful or off-putting in smell, but otherwise perfectly fine to utilize?
Is there a disagreement in the real world among people when maybe you can't necessarily prove it one way or the other? Or maybe even you can, right? Necromancers might be like, oh yeah, it's fine. It's just you know, a plane of negative energy and we use that for power, but the soul has gone on and it doesn't matter. Look, I can you know, commune with the spirit of a person who's dead, but the corpse is here and, you know, they're not the same thing. You still can have paladins who are like, no.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, if 2020 has taught anything, it should be that the truth should not get in the way of whatever story you're going to tell. Like, because it doesn't matter if you're absolutely 100%, you know, proof positive that, you know, there's no greater cost to creating undead than the corpse that they consume. Somebody out there will wholeheartedly believe that that is not true and fight you about it.
Yeah, look how hard it is to get people in the real world to be okay with cannibalism. When, like, it's demonstrably provable not to hurt anybody.
Doesn't it give you brain worms?
Only if you eat people's brains.
Okay, great.
But if you crash in the Andes, then, you know, you do what you got to do. So, the Pope literally called it communion later.
I think Jesus called it communion. If I recall how that story goes.
I mean,
but certainly Peter ritualized it.
I mean, Jesus was like, I mean, eat me.
Come yeah. That's why I always say eat my shorts.
They're undead too.
Crap.
This is a good time for us to sort of talk about a little bit about like social contract and lines of and veils, though, because, you know, when you're talking about corpses and dead bodies and like not just like, oh, off to the side and I defeated an enemy, right? Then there are potential issues with people getting icked out or grossed out or there's body horror. So you want to have the conversation ahead of time about like, is this something people are okay talking about in detail? And is this okay maybe with people? Like, if I'm going to sort of find some humor in this, are people okay with that as well?
Yeah, I think this is important. Like, the existence of necromancy in the rulebook does not necessarily consent everyone to the horror of necromancy at the table, right? You know, even like in the Gates of Mourning campaign, where we're dealing pretty heavily with undead and necromancers, like, there's some buy-in from the rest of us that this is cool versus just like icking us out and body horroring us for a year and a half. Because, hey, you know what? There's undead in the book.
Yeah, like when we did session zero for Band of Blades, one of the initial things that you do in that game is like pick which, what are they called again? Not the chosen, but the opposite of them.
Oh.
The broken.
The broken.
You pick which broken that the game is going to center on, and that determines themes. And one of them is really focused on like necromancy and body horror. And like the players, we were like, I think I don't want to do that one. Let's do the, like, the Rage of War one.
Yeah.
That seems less icky.
You guys absolutely noped out of that.
Yeah.
I was like, I kind of have good ideas for these two. And you guys were like, well, not that one. So default two.
Let's do the Anger Punch one. Let's do that one.
Yeah. We all agree war's bad. Let's make it more bad. So then we should talk about some caveats and pitfalls that just come with necromancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most important one here is like, there are players who just want to show up and cast their spells, you know, like they just want to play the game. It's an interesting mechanic to them. And adding in the whole question of perception and morality just hinders the school in a way that other magics aren't burdened with. And if they're not interested in that, that's just a tax on their fun. Like, I spent resources to get these spells, and now you're telling me I can't use them because of other things that aren't burdening the guy with fireball? Like, that just kind of sucks for me.
Right. Why are all the peasants afraid of me when, like, I put a hat on it? You know what I mean?
you raise one body and you're a monster. You create hundreds of bodies and you're a wizard. Okay.
So you can get in these situations where, like, the player is like, man, I just wanted to, like, have minions, but, like, hiring's form, those are NPCs and that's too much work for the GM. Like, I just wanted lots of tokens, man.
Yeah. Like, you know, Diablo 2 or the expansion Diablo 2 had, like, the Necromancer as a playable character, right? And there was no difference in your playthrough. There were no questions of, is it cool that you raise dead? You know, like, it was just more mechanics to the game. Like, if I'm a person coming from that kind of gaming environment to now, like, oh, necromancy is negative, and you should have known before you started your character that, like, there's all these caveats to necromancy. Like, I don't know. That's a conversation you should have up front, because if you want to introduce, like, a bigger thing about a school of magic, anybody using that school of magic should kind of be involved in creating it, in my opinion.
Right. You didn't have, like, gendarmes showing up at your door because you're a divination wizard. And they're like, well, we have strict rules about surveillance. Okay.
Yeah.
Another thing about necromancy, and we talked a bit about this in the episode on bringing back the dead, is that if it's commonplace and easy, it can lower the stakes because, you know, first off, if a PC dies, you can get them back pretty easily, which means you have players who just aren't that afraid of losing a character. It makes things less dramatic. It makes you a little less afraid. It makes characters maybe more foolhardy or reckless.
Yeah. And so, like, I think generally, overly cautious PCs are more challenging to GM and to GM for than overly ambitious ones. Like, PCs who take an active role in anything are always going to be easier to play with. But that can be a big challenge to tone when you're looking for something that's dark and gritty, where, you know, like, death is permanent and you will die face down in the mud. And it's like, okay, I died face down in the mud. That was my story. I'm back for round two, three rounds later, because we had a 300 gold piece diamond handy.
Right. And a lot of the times, mechanically, the only gate is money. And right. So once you get past the, like, I'm not tracking every gold piece anymore that most games hit, you know, mid-game, then suddenly you don't even need to track deaths anymore.
Yeah. I think that's, again, this can all work, right? There's no reason that you can't elevate out of the dark and gritty and into something far more heroic because you have this ability, right? That could make your party unique and uniquely able to do things. It's just changes the tone of the game. And then the other thing, I feel like when players don't fear the consequences of their PC's actions, like specifically death, like they don't fear losing their PC, they may just default to violence because it's more direct. And that reduces other avenues of gameplay. You know, you're less likely to negotiate or steal or, you know, sneak or whatever, manipulate when you can just hit it with an axe. Because there's a bunch of rules in the game for hitting with an axe, and there's fewer rules for the other things. If you're just going to use your axe more often because you can get resurrected afterwards, like, you lose some of the variety in the game as well.
Right. I didn't need to take any of those other skills. I took violence.
Right. And then we've talked about this a bit in the divination episode as well, but your necromancy spells can also shortcut the investigation. If you're attempting that, you know, if you can speak with dead or resurrect somebody or soul cage somebody who's died, you can get access to information that wasn't necessarily expected, or doesn't follow sort of your traditional investigative tropes that now the GM has to adapt for.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're running these kinds of things, keep in mind that these are abilities that people have heard about and they exist in the world, which means that criminals are going to be prepared for them. So we discussed this on previous episodes, but generally speaking, if you're playing out like a murder mystery or something like that, the necromancy spell or the divination spell or whatever should provide the next clue rather than solving the entire mystery. So you don't find it, you don't like see a vision of like, oh, here was my murderer and I can see myself getting stabbed, right? But you see something in the mirror or out of the corner of the eye because, of course, you know, you are, you know, hit from behind because everyone knows you can just ask a corpse who killed you. So the killer's going to make sure they're not seen.
Right. Or they're going to have some illusion or something that makes them appear differently than they otherwise would.
Exactly. I'm going to make sure that I was seen because this is a frame up.
Exactly. The other thing is then if the players are, you know, asking those kinds of direct questions, you don't have an omniscience, right? So you could be wrong, but you also just might not know the answer. But if you have players who are caught on a red herring, this can be an opportunity to get them on the right track, right? Like, and that's whether you set them on a red herring and want to get them back, or they've invented one whole cloth because they're players, which happens all the time. like them using a Speak with Dead spell to advance on that red herring can use that to set them right back on track. Like, the answer is no, I wasn't killed by the priest. I was killed by this person. Now go prove it.
Right, you idiots.
Right.
I've been trying to give you cryptic responses, and you know, did you not see the candles flickering when there was no wind? But you ignore that, and now I've used up the last of my ectoplasmic energy to show up here bodily. Great.
It was Morse code, you fools.
Right, like at any time in a world with necromancy, have Jacob Marley show up, man. If people really need like a hook, the hook is, I'm wrapped in chains. Don't be me.
So conveniently, the fifth edition provides the caveat for Speak with Dead that, you know, you get cryptic responses. They might be repetitive. They might be unclear. Unlike Wish, it does not matter how good the question was. So the response is kind of whatever you need it to be. You know, the dead might just be repeating the same thing over and over again to hammer it home because that's the most important thing to them and to the investigation.
Yeah, one nice thing here is you get multiple questions, which means that, you know, if you want to like play up a bit of humor or some personality or whatever, or train the party to ask better questions or the right questions, you can, you know, give them a snarky response or give them like a cloudy response that it doesn't give them no information. It tells them that the way that they phrased a question or the avenue that they're pursuing is not the right one. So like, try something else. So, you know, they're spending part of a resource in order to sort of hone the rest of it.
And then you just need to make sure that at the end of the spell, right, at the end of the investment, they feel like they got something of value out of it. Like, nothing is worse than, cool, I spend my fifth level spell to speak to this dead person out of combat, and all I learned was my GM wasn't going to give me any information. I should have just rolled investigation.
Mm-hmm. Right, great. I'm going to swap this out next level.
Yeah, exactly. This is the last time I cast Speak with Dead.
Uh-huh. Of course, if you're in a situation where like you're, you know, playing 5e and you've got a warlock who can cast it at will, like maybe the dead start getting snarky.
Right.
You know, because like it's not a wasted resource. Oh, you again?
Yeah.
Fine.
I've heard about you in the afterlife. You're the guy who just keeps spamming us like with these crank phone calls.
We're really excited to see you soon.
And then I think the other thing to keep in mind is often if you go full necromancy, you end up with a lot of like summoned and conjured creatures, right? Like you raise undead around you and you have to like manage those minions just like conjurers do. So make sure that you're getting the stat blocks for the things you're creating, that you can manage them, that you have a way of tracking their stats, their hit points. That's not going to slow down gameplay. Fortunately, necromancers tend to have a pretty limited pool of options. You know, you pretty much need zombie, skeleton, and ghoul, and you're good to go.
Yeah. And if you have the option of getting, you know, a singular, more powerful minion versus like multiple less powerful ones, it's usually easier at the table to have one more powerful one. And honestly, I think usually it's probably more fun.
Yeah. Unless you just want to roll like six attacks with your skeletons and then move on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like mass combat.
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, and that's what I would encourage. If you do end up with multiple, is like try to give simple commands like attack this thing and then just roll things very directly. Like don't over optimize your action economy on your add-on minions, because boy, is that boring for everybody else at the table.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that I think happens a lot with necromancies, you'll see questions from people who are like, all right, here's how necromancy works in my setting, and like this is what happens to the soul, and here's what raising the dead does, et cetera, et cetera. here's my moral quandary. And they set up this like scenario where, oh, you know, it's a society that, you know, uses the dead for labor and blah, 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 all of these things, right? And people are searching for an answer about like, what is the right way to deal with this kind of society? Or like, how should good or evil PCs view a society that does this or a person who does this sort of thing? And I think it all really just sort of boils down to like, in the lore of your setting, actually decide what happens when you die and what happens when you come back. And then from there, the logic just sort of spins out, but there isn't necessarily a right answer. Part of the fun comes from people in game disagreeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like we touched on, like the religious aspect of what you believe happens after death, and then the, you know, kind of scientific magical aspect of what actually happens after death.
Yeah. So, you know, you have the scenario where all physical labor is done by corpses. Okay. Some people might find that icky. Some people might find that abhorrent. A paladin of the god of death might say that this is an abomination and needs to be destroyed. And now let's have a fun conversation about it. Let's argue about it in character. And then let's argue about it with the NPCs. And like, guess what you've just created? A story.
Right.
So, which is the whole point.
Okay, we set off on a quest to prove one of us right.
What if I just kill them all and literally let God sort them out? And then, you know, you just bring back whomever.
Buddy, I have bad news. The gods aren't real either. The power was in you all along.
And now you're dead. It's okay. We that's why we set up our town next to this diamond mine.
Right. As we wrap this up, gotta ask the question, have you ever played a necromancer and would you?
I mean, definitely would. Have I played a necromancer? This is interesting. I am not usually one for summons or minions or things like that, partially because it's just of all the paperwork of having, you know, additional stat blocks.
Yeah,
because
you're not an accountant.
Yeah, you're right. That's why my parents are disappointed. The only reason why they're disappointed.
Right.
But multiple times I've played a revenant, which is an undead PC who's like come back from the dead and has agency. Because I really like the trappings of, I think it's kind of the same reason that I like playing Warforged or like droids, is that I like the idea of like a non-living body that can kind of be viewed as a tool. Right. So you can do really cool things. And I like the idea of doing this when you're a necromancer as well. Like really viewing the body as a tool to be used or a weapon, where most people are looking at it as a person.
As so, you know, the self, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd have revenants do things like jump off towers to like land on the ground. If you're like a normal like barbarian, you might do that if you're a crazy person. and you're just like hoping I have enough hit points to tank this, right? Barbarian's feather fall is like absorb the damage and get up and limp away. But like as a revenant, who cares if you like break your kneecaps and like shatter the your ankles? Like, all right, that hurts, whatever. But pain doesn't matter anymore. I'm already dead.
Right.
Who cares if, like, you know, my fighting style is crazy because I don't care if you run me through, because that's not really me anymore. It's just it's ablative armor to be used for my soul.
Right.
And I like the idea of necromancers also doing that as well. It's like, yeah, I got a whole village behind me, and I'm going to throw them at you like bullets. And part of that is like the psychological warfare of like, this is creepy and you don't like that, and that puts you off your game, and that's why I'm so good at this. But part of it is also just like it's a different kind of mindset that you can get into, and it's one of those things that you can do in a game that, like, dear Lord, you can't do in real life.
Yeah. I struggle with necromancy because, like, often I feel like I'm just picking the counter narrative, right? Like, we're a good party, but I'm the bad one. Similar mm-hmm. to like how a lot of like warlocks end up, you know, like if you lean into whatever your fiendish patron is instead of like, you know, fear reprisal of your fiendish patron, like you can just kind of end up being like Captain Premise rejection.
Yeah.
And so I really struggle with that because I don't think there's a ton of payoff for being a necromancer, right? Like, I don't particularly enjoy managing a pile of minions. I don't want to slow down combat trying to do that. So, like, that's a big part of the benefit of going necromancy. And, like, I struggle with, like, why do this when I could just be, like, fully invested in the plot instead of sort of always running parallel to it.
Yeah, I think if I'm going to play a necromancer, I want it to be a part of the game, because otherwise I'm not in love with the flavor.
Right.
So, like, you know, if we're doing Eberron, I would play a Carnathian necromancer because, like, it's embedded within the lore.
Right. Yeah, that's the exception, I would say, is, like, if I can be, you know, somebody from my culture where this isn't strange, and in a place where that culture is going to be at least not vilified. Maybe not respected across Corvair, but, like, you know, if a Carnathy goes and creates an undead, and it's probably gonna be an incident, but it's not gonna be, like, chased out of town with pitchforks, like, burned at the stake kind of thing. So mm-hmm. I think that is probably, like, one of the few environments where, like, I would be really into playing a necromancy focused character, whether that's a, you know, a necromancer wizard or something else.
Totally.
All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
The desperate creak of bones that have been given new life. Isn't it almost Halloween? Probably is.
It's getting there. But it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. And before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. So, Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by Elderwood Academy.
Elderwood Academy are artisans who craft amazing gaming products, including dice towers, dice trays, dice boxes, deck boxes, dice, and more. All products are crafted to look like spellbooks, scroll cases, codices, and other awesome fantasy gear that we love.
So in these times of social distancing, Ishan, I cannot overstate the value that I have gotten out of my scroll rolling tray, because it turns out rolling at my desk is messy, even more so than on a normal, like, stuffed gaming tabletop.
Right, you're like, your work stuff is over here, and then there's, like, the detritus of lunch still here because I haven't actually gotten up from this table.
Yep, I got a keyboard. I got about a, you know, like a 3x3 space where I can safely roll my die, and if it overrolls, then I've got to go dig it out, or it falls off and then it's stuck behind a nest of wires for my computer. It's a whole nightmare.
A lot of the time what I will do is I actually do gaming night, like, sitting on the bed now.
We noticed.
I know. I hold myself up in the bedroom, but that means that, like, I don't have the big table at, like, you know, your place or Stefan Cam's place where we would normally be rolling the dice. So I need, like, a soft surface, and, like, I guess a book works, but also books don't have sides.
Yeah, exactly. So for once, not speaking about the portability of the scroll rolling tray, but the pure rolling tray functionality of it. You know, it's leather. It folds up into a nice little cylindrical bag, and then unfolds, and the sides are wood. They're carved. You can kind of get whatever icon or color pattern wood type that you want. Yeah, I mean, it's a product that I have personally used for, like, 3 years now.
All right, so if that sounds interesting, you can find the scroll rolling tray and many more products at elderwoodacademy.com/don't-split.
All right, this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building Ash.
Who is?
The Iceborn War Mother of the Avarosan Tribe, a Frost Archer who... Nope, that's the wrong Ash. That's the League of Legends Ash. We are building the leader of the Deadlock Gang, a gunslinging cowgirl armed with her rifle and coach gun, dynamite, and her best friend, Bob.
I like both of these, but all right. What is the build?
So the build is College of Whispers Bard 10, Scout Rogue 5, Champion Fighter 5.
All right, so Scout Rogue, we'll start with 5 levels to get us Expertise, 3d6 Sneak Attack, Cunning Action for Speed, and to be able to hide quickly or disengage, which makes you extraordinarily mobile. Skirmisher lets you move half your speed as a reaction when an enemy ends their turn within 5 feet.
Yeah, this is your coach gun. This is your blast yourself away from anybody who tries to walk up to you.
Survivalist gives you expertise in nature and survival, and then Uncanny Dodge lets you have the damage from an incoming attack.
Which I find interesting, because Ash is immune to her own dynamite. So if she blows it up in her own face, she doesn't take damage.
I mean, same.
Then from Champion Fighter 5, we'll start with fighting style archery to get some accuracy on our ranged attacks. We'll get second wind for a little more health. And then at level 2, we get action surge so we can attack twice. And then at level 3, what we're really here for is improved critical. So we'll crit on a 19 or 20. And then we can take it to 5 to get extra attack. Now, you can only sneak attack once per turn. You're more likely to crit on more attacks with improved critical. But we want more damage that we can throw onto those crits whenever possible. So we end up looking at College of Whispers Bard.
So that'll give you spellcasting up to 5th level. Bard spells are great. You get a bardic inspiration die. It'll end up being a D10 jack of all trades, just so you're, you know, good at pretty much everything, and then a D10 song of rest to help your allies on a rest. But we're actually here for psychic blades.
Yeah, this is all about empowering your crits. These are your rifle headshots as Ash. Psychic blades lets you spend a bardic inspiration die on a hit to add up to 5d6 psychic damage at level 10. It keeps increasing every couple levels.
You also get Words of Terror. You can force a creature to make a wisdom save if you're able to speak to it for a minute. This is a nice bit of, you know, an ability that you can use out of combat. A lot of the bard abilities you'll probably be leaning on for social encounters.
Yeah, and Ash, as the leader of the Deadlock Gang, is, you know, kind of a criminal underlord. So it makes sense if you spend a minute with her that you might leave kind of unsure of yourself, maybe trying to get out of there as quickly as possible when she's training a rifle on you.
Then we'll get 2 more expertises. And then at level 5, Font of Inspiration means that your bardic dice refresh on a short rest rather than a long rest. So then you can just churn out your psychic blades as often as possible.
Then at level 6, we'll get Mantle of Whispers. This lets you adopt the persona of a humanoid who dies within 30 feet of you. I don't know. This one doesn't really fit the character, but, you know, whatever. She's a criminal. She can always use a disguise to pull a heist or, you know, rob a train, whatever it takes.
Yeah, or when you shoot somebody, what do? You take all their stuff and then you dress up like them.
Exactly.
All right, and then at 10, Capstone, you get 2 more expertises and then Magical Secrets.
So this is where we're going to get our dynamite in the form of Fireball, and we will get Bob, our ultimate ability, which will be summon elemental. You'll want an earth elemental for Bob. Bob is a large omnic that goes charging in, knocks people out of the way, and then starts shooting them very angrily. So he's got a ton of health. I think earth elemental fits nicely here.
Yeah, it sounds exactly like an earth elemental, although the optimal move with earth elemental is have it go inside the ground and then attack people from there with advantage.
Yeah. So, Ishan, it's been a while since we've done character ideas in the Forge, but who is your Ash?
So my Ash, hearkening back to earlier in the episode, is a Ghostbuster. And is shooting, you know, a proton pack here, but I think I'm gonna mix things up a little bit. We've got a lot of Ghostbusters lore that doesn't always necessarily match up with the, you know, the movies or the TV shows or things like that. I think she's got a little bit of ghosts in her. Spent maybe a little too much time with Slimer or you know, in the afterlife. And on occasion, she can sort of manifest her own sort of like ectoplasmic goo. Now, maybe that comes out in the proton pack or, you know, a weapon and shoots out like a terrifying visage, which ends up being when you use the psychic blades. Or maybe it's just, you know, turning her face into like a spooky, terrifying horror like the librarian that we meet in the original Ghostbusters. So I think she sort of like fights fire with fire. Maybe even in the Old West.
All right.
And now, of course, I want like an Old West Ghostbusters adaptation.
Yeah. I mean, that's that has to have been in the cartoon, right?
Oh, yeah. They must have gone back in time. There was a Sherlock Holmes adaptation.
Okay.
All right. Who's your Ash?
Have you ever seen the hit film Enemy at the Gates?
I have not.
Okay, so it is. It's based on a novel called War of the Rats, which is about a Russian sniper during the Battle of Stalingrad who...
Oh, wait, I have seen just this the scene I know you're about to talk about on YouTube.
I'm not even talking about a specific scene. I'm just talking about the general archetype of the sniper in a war, in a siege, in a campaign, who is just picking off the enemy enemy officers, right? Serving as like sort of this faceless terror from, you know, a great distance, who is just sowing discord and kind of deflating morale of the enemy. I suppose the same thing happened in American Sniper, just with better branding, I guess. But the idea here being that that Ash is an expert marksman whose whole kind of shtick is her ability to kind of get in, use her disguise, use her like craftiness, use her ability to infiltrate, get that perfect shot on high priority targets and demoralize and sow chaos within the ranks of enemy armies or you know, even within, you know, the besieged troops within a city. Sort of the fantasy freedom fighter.
I like this as a premise for like a one-on-one game. Like a 1-2-1 game.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely plays better in a party if you're like, you know, just rotated out of military service. Maybe now you're just finding yourself with a certain set of skills and a lot of free time on your hands.
Right. I just need to perch and right. I'll do my thing.
Exactly. All right, before we wrap up, let's take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And don't forget, if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, we will read it on the air. It's a great way to help others find the show.
We are talking about next week's episode? Using the Tarrasque.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building May.
Well, that's it for episode 271 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by Cobalt Press.
The Scarlet Citadel is a 5th edition Dungeon of Secrets, and it is now live on Kickstarter.
It is a classic multi-level dungeon for 5th edition gaming, a place of dungeon crawling, treasure looting, and morphing battle maps.
So the project will create 6 main items that you can get your hands on. A hardcover book in both regular and limited editions, and a hand-tooled rich leather edition.
A map folio of poster-sized, table-ready battle maps to play on.
And a fully optimized PDF. Also a digital edition for the Roll20 virtual tabletop.
And a digital edition for the Fantasy Grounds virtual tabletop, in case, you know, social distancing goes the distance and we have to keep playing online.
You know, one thing we didn't talk about? I like the idea that you have a leather folio or, you know, just a piece of leather in your game around a book or chair or whatever, and you use necromancy on that. Now I've made all these inanimate objects come back to life.
Raise cow. All right, so the Scarlet Citadel is now on Kickstarter. Follow the link in the show notes. What an ad.